Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
It is easy to leave a burning building when it is on fire. But what if that building contains the very thing that gives you life, excitement, peace, joy, courage, and wonder? Will you be an agent of change, or do nothing and eventually leave? If you work in Catholic ministry, business, or education, and need quality content on your website or social media pages, contact The Simple Catholic for copywriting services at thesimplecatholic.blog and click on the writing services page for more information. The Church Militant needs soldiers against the enemy. Enlist The Simple Catholic in this fight for the truth. Good News Ministries of GNM.org. It's the Catholic place for growing your faith. Good News Ministries will provide you with faith-building reflections, virtual retreats, prayer resources, and lots more. All of it is free. Visit GNM.org today.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger, and it's always a joy to have as my guest, my good friend, Catholic author, popular speaker, poet, and songwriter, Mike Aquilina. Mike serves as the Executive Vice President of the St. Paul Center for Biblical Theology. He's a contributing editor to Angelus News as well. And he's the author or editor of more than 50 books, including The Fathers of the Church, The Mass of the Early Christians, and Angels of God, just to name a few. Mike has co-hosted 11 series on EWTN and hosted two documentaries. He's written companion volumes to the NBC miniseries AD, The Bible Continues, and the MGM remake of the movie Ben-Hur. Today, we're going to be discussing a new one from him, and actually an entire new series he's the editor of. The series is called Reclaiming Catholic History, and the title of his book, the first in the series, is The Church in the Roman Empire. Welcome back to the show, Mike.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Pete.
Hey, you're welcome. So, I guess out of the gate, you're the editor of this new series from Ave Maria Press, Reclaiming Catholic History. Before we get to your particular title that leads it off, can you tell us what the series is about? How many books they're planning to have in it, and just a brief overview of what it is.
Well, it's about history, and it's a project of reclaiming it, as you can guess from the the title. But it's when you see a title like that, you dig back and you find that that there are a lot of misconceptions out there. There's a lot of misinformation, a lot of disinformation, and a lot of urban legends, frankly, about Catholic history. What we want to do is look at each and every period over the last 2,000 years, and set the record straight. You know, talk about what really happened. We don't want to shy away from any of the difficulties. We don't want to say that bad people were good or good people were bad. We want to set the record straight, and we want people to understand the events the way they occurred. Since the Reformation and the Enlightenment, there has been a strong anti-Catholic current in the writing of history and in other academic disciplines. There's been a bias against Catholicism that was established by people, philosophers and activists who wanted to overthrow the church and oppose it in various ways. So we're kind of battling against that, and that's what we want to do with this series. Another thing we want to undo with this series is the perception of history that a lot of us carry over from high school, and that's that history is boring. That it's all about memorizing dates and names and spots on a map, and that's not the case. It's about reading great stories with vivid characters, and that's what we're hoping to reestablish for people with this series.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I found great about your particular entry, the first one here, is that it's you storytell. You don't lay it out in like a bland, dry textbook format. Is that what we can expect from the entire series?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, that's why we went after people who were not only, accomplished academics. We have recruited a number of writers who are accomplished academics, but also good writers, you know, professional writers, people who have made a living out of telling stories. So we want the books to overcome the urban legends, as I said. We want them to debunk false history and a lot of the rumors that are out there. But we also want it to be a vivid page turner of a book, mm-hmm. you know, as entertaining to read as any best-selling novel.
So your particular entry, The Church in the Roman Empire, covers the years 301 to 490. Is there any particular reason you were tasked with that time frame? Was it one you chose?
Well, I worked with the publisher to divide up the periods in history, and this one we chose because we begin that period in 301, right before Christianity was legalized. We're beginning the story during the time of fiercest persecution under the Romans. It's the persecution of Diocletian, and so we see how bad everything was just before it got good. Christianity was legalized then in the early 300s, and Constantine, a Christian emperor, took the throne. And so the fortunes of the church changed almost overnight, mm-hmm. from a time of persecution and martyrdom to a time of hegemony, really. I would say that there's a lot of misunderstanding about that period too, and I wanted to overcome that. But I wanted to begin the story with the low point that the Christians were experiencing right before the legalization of Christianity, and then I wanted to take it through to the fall of Rome, to that final season of the Roman years when it's still the period we call the era of the fathers, mm-hmm. but Rome was clearly in decline at that time.
Right, and you mentioned it there, and you also point out in the book that for the early Christians, we hear a lot about how dangerous of a time it was for them and the difficulties they faced, but you also mentioned in the book that there were good times as well. Can you speak a bit to that mix of good and bad times and how it all meshed together?
Well, the good times, what I mean by good times is that the church grew during the period of persecution at a pretty steady rate of 40% per decade. So you think about it. Christianity was illegal. It was a capital crime. It was punishable by death. And yet people were converting to the church in droves. I mean, when was the last time you visited a parish that was growing at a rate of 40% per decade? And the church sustained that rate of growth over 300 years. So you can look at those 300 years as a time when thousands and maybe tens of thousands of Christians were martyred. Or you can look at it as a time when millions of pagans became Christians, because both stories are true. You know, it was the worst of times. It was the best of times. It all depends on how you look at it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And looking at some of those worst of times, you know, the persecution of Christians, and you and I have discussed this before, in the decades after Jesus' own death escalated quite rapidly. You write in this book of Nero's rather over-the-top tactics. And I think some listeners need to understand how extreme they were. Can you tell us a bit about what early Christians ended up enduring?
Well, the Romans wanted to make sure they didn't miss anybody. So they just required sacrifice to the gods of everyone. You know, I mean, they required everyone to come forward and burn incense or offer some sort of sacrifice. And they'd have everybody line up. And once you offered your sacrifice, you would get a certificate, a libellus, this little piece of paper that said you had, you know, you had complied with the law and you were free to go. And if anyone stopped you on the street and you were asked to present that, you'd have to. Otherwise, you could be rounded up and made to do it again, or imprisoned and tried as a Christian. So you know, Diocletian really kind of instituted this as a universal requirement, and he and so you had a situation where there were many deaths, and at this time Christianity had been ascendant for so long that in some of the cities, Pete, the Christians made up a majority of the people in the city, or the largest plurality by far. So this meant a lot of people were going to their death or being imprisoned or being publicly tortured simply because they were Christians.
Mm. You know, with Nero, Diocletian, and all this things going on to the Christians, what you also point out, and that's rather interesting, is this tactic backfired. And even the Roman citizens themselves at one point finally started to feel compassion for the Christians. Isn't that right?
Yeah, well, you know, Tacitus makes note of that. You know, even in the first century, you have him writing about the persecution of Nero, and he said that that Nero planned this as a spectacle to entertain the people, lighting the Christians on fire and using them as torches for a party in his gardens. And Tacitus notes that this had the opposite effect, that it gained the sympathy of the people because it seemed just a simple act of cruelty and not an act of justice. And they expected their emperors to be just, to be good judges. You know, a little bit later, you find Tertullian observing that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, that when the martyr's blood is spilled, it inspires others. You know, people see them die, and they want to possess that same kind of courage. They want to possess that same kind of purpose because they're not feeling that at the moment. Justin Martyr said that he was converted, at least in part, because he witnessed the martyrdom of several Christians. So this has always been the case. The blood of the martyrs is seed. That was true throughout the first century, second century, third century, and into the fourth century, where my book begins.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back to discuss more about the early church. We're with Mike Aquilina. You've been listening to Off the Shelf. We'll be right back.
Popular blogger Catherine Whitaker is a Dr. Pepper superfan, Aggie-loving type A mom of six, with a personality the size of her native Texas. The stressful, premature birth of her fifth child threw her orderly world into chaos and ultimately led her to rethink her priorities. In her new book, Live Big, Love Bigger, Catherine Whitaker shares her journey and challenges you to understand that you too can live a life of authenticity with joy-filled purpose, love, and faith. Her sassy authenticity will make you laugh and cry while encouraging you to be honest about mistakes in every area of your life. Embrace them and find a way to let God redeem it all. Check out Live Big, Love Bigger at Ave Maria Press, or look for it wherever books and ebooks are sold.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf. We're spending it today with Mike Aquilina discussing his new book, The Church and the Roman Empire, the first book in the Reclaiming Catholic History series from Ave Maria Press. So, Mike, I guess a good way to pick up the second segment here is, what ultimately turned the tide? How was it that under these conditions, Christianity not only survived, but thrived in remarkable fashion?
I have to say, you know, it's to the Christians at that time, it seemed that it was just an act of God. It was an intervention of God because, you know, Constantine, as he was fighting to gain the throne, was an underdog, and yet he managed to overcome all the odds through a seemingly supernatural event. He saw a cross in the sky, and he heard a voice that said, "By this sign you shall conquer." And sure enough, the next day he did. He conquered, and it was Constantine who first granted freedom to the Christians. Now, there's a lot of misunderstanding about this. People think that Constantine became a Christian and imposed Christianity on the empire. But he didn't. What Constantine did was establish freedom of religion. He established religious liberty for the first time in human history. He said that in matters of religion, people should be free to follow their conscience. And this had never been the case in any ancient culture. Constantine was sympathetic to Christianity. You know, he had not yet been baptized, but he was fair to the pagans, and he made sure that their freedom was protected as well. That's what he did right away. You know, then that was really the answer to Christians' prayers over 275 years thereabouts, as they were persecuted. They were praying for the peace of the church, and this was the act that brought peace.
And a somewhat surprising act, because no one expected, you know, it to come from from where it came from.
That's what I was saying. You know, it seemed to them an act of God, mm-hmm. that they should get such an emperor, and that the tide should turn so quickly. Now, when we look back on it, it seems like the tide turned and everything kept flowing in that direction from then on. But we have to keep in mind that the Christians did not know security, really, because they knew darn well that your fortunes could change with the succession to the throne, that a new emperor could come along and just change the situation entirely. And sure enough, later in the 4th century, they experienced persecution once again under the rule of Julian, who was a nephew of Constantine and an ex-Christian, a former Christian, someone who had renounced the faith and was hell-bent on re-paganizing the empire. The Christians could never quite relax in that century. It took time, you know, for them to exhale and know that they were in a secure position in the empire.
Right. It's different for us looking back than being the people living in that time. For sure. You tell in the book, and this I think draws into that storytelling aspect of the book, you tell of St. Justin Martyr's account of Julia and Antonius and the typical Roman couple, and that writing, and I thought was fantastic. It painted the picture of how the typical Roman's life really was pretty much a meaningless one. Could you share that with us?
Well, you have to think about what it was like living before the Christian Revolution. Okay, you believe in the gods, maybe, and you even offer sacrifice to the gods, but you don't have a relationship with the gods. And the gods are not about goodness and rightness. They live whimsical lives. Okay, we as Christians believe in one God, and we offer sacrifice to that one God, and we try to live according to his statutes because they're reasonable. The Romans did not believe that their gods were reasonable or just. The gods, as I said, were whimsical. Christianity offered you a God who was lovable and who wanted to give you love, who wanted to love you back. This is the God who first loved you into existence. This is the God who would hear your prayers and wanted you to be good, wanted you to be excellent, wanted you to have virtue. All of these things that we take for granted in Christianity were not part of the Roman religion, really. Religion had little to do with morality in their world. So they looked at what Christians were doing. They looked at the way Christians were living, and they saw that Christian husbands were faithful to their wives, that wives were faithful to their husbands, that their children seemed to be happy, that they gave their children a compelling vision of life and right and wrong, that they acquired virtue even though they were uneducated in some cases, that they lived cheerful lives in spite of their privations and in spite of persecution, even that they had courage. They were willing to die for a cause because they had a cause that they were willing to live for. If you were a typical pagan in that time, you were enjoying none of these things. The family was falling apart. Marriage was a mess. Infanticide was common, as were abortion and contraception. You know, everything was falling apart for the Romans, and they were trying to shore it all up by means of the state, and it wasn't working. Mm. So they looked to the Christians, and they saw really people who were examples of good lives, and they were willing to follow that example by becoming a Christian. That's what inspired conversions.
Right, right. And, you know, dovetailing off that, perhaps the greatest thing Christians did to help their cause was simply being themselves. And I think a particularly good example of that was during the time of the plague. I mean, irregardless of sick person's affiliations, Christians were there to help.
They were. As a matter of fact, that's when the first hospitals in all of history were established, and they were established as Christian institutions. The Christians invented the hospitals so that they could offer care to others. Why were they doing that? Well, because Jesus was a healer, and they wanted to imitate him. And when Jesus sent out his disciples, he sent them with the command to heal the sick. And so Christians wanted to follow Jesus by doing what he did. And the hospital was a natural outgrowth of that. It was a remarkable development in history because the pagans had all of the medical and technological and other assets that were required to establish a hospital, but they never succeeded in doing so because they lacked a couple of things. One, they lacked this idea of charity, self-giving, life-giving love. And they also lacked the courage to do so, the fortitude to lay down one's life for someone else. Because during that time, there were no antibiotics, there was no antisepsis. People were relatively powerless against disease. And yet Christians made sure that the sick would have care, even though it meant that Christian doctors were at risk themselves.
Mm. You know, you write about one particular event in the book, and there's a ton of them you write about, but that many say changed Roman sentiment, and that is the martyrdom of St. Agnes. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes. Well, there we have an example of a young girl, maybe 11, 12 years old, who was very beautiful, and she came from the nobility. So she was from a wealthy family. And beauty and wealth were two things that the Romans very much admired, just as Americans do today. Celebrity seems to be based on beauty and wealth. Well, the Romans had the same tendency, and so they looked to Agnes as someone special. Well, Agnes is very beautiful. This pagan, young pagan, wanted to marry her, wanted to take her in marriage, and she refused him, because she said she had consecrated her virginity to Jesus Christ. She intended to live her life essentially as what we would call today a nun. The man was very upset about this, and since Christianity was illegal, he just went to the local magistrate and denounced her as a Christian. The magistrate threatened her with torture, and she was unfazed. She was unafraid, and he showed her the instruments of torture that would be used on her, and she didn't care. You know, she was ready to die as a martyr. Well, she did die as a martyr. She died a very public execution, and it seems that the Romans saw that happened, and they saw what they had become, that they recognized their own depravity, and as they saw the virtue and the goodness and the purity of this young girl, and her courage, because she was more courageous than any of those men who were putting her to death. You know, they're picking on a little girl, which even then was seen as the height of cowardice. Mm. And she showed them what true courage was. She showed them what truth was. And I believe that was a turning point in Roman history and in Christian history.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting throughout this entire period you write about, and not to diminish any other martyrs that we see throughout the centuries, but it seems like in this time period, the martyrs that we see had a huge effect on the outcome of history.
Yeah, I think that's because the population of Christians had reached a critical mass. Everybody knew Christians, and so people were watching their friends, their neighbors, even public figures, people they admired, being taken and tortured publicly and killed. So yes, it was a very public event. It had it had implications for people in your neighborhood, and so it drove the point home. And that's just where we were in relation to the empire at that time.
We're going to take another quick break. We'll be back to wrap up our discussion of the church and the Roman Empire. We'll be right back.
Are you married? I'd like to suggest that you often return to the fond and true memory of your spouse when you first met and on your wedding day. Well, he or she is still that same lovable person. Perhaps life has presented many challenges you did not expect back then, but you have come through these together. And the providential fire of your tribulations and your love has forged you into the one body you are today. And that is a beautiful thing. Never let anyone or any inferior thing tear you and your spouse asunder. God is one with you. He is love. Your marriage is love. And love endures whatever comes. It does not come to an end. See 1 Corinthians 13. I'm Jim Littleton of FormingFaithfulFamilies.com.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf here on Breadbox Media. We've been spending today with Mike Aquilina discussing his book, The Church and the Roman Empire. And Mike, way back in segment one, we touched upon Constantine. And the thing that I find particularly interesting about him is, you know, he had this vision or he had this desire to, in a sense, help Christians, but it wasn't easy. And he stuck with his plan, so to speak. He stumbled upon these local rifts while he was working on this, particularly in Africa, and he had to figure out which truly was the quote-unquote Catholic Church. So how difficult was this, and how did he end up resolving it?
Yes, you know, you bring up the real difficulty there that Christianity was finally legal. It was finally out in the open, and forced out into the open, it showed its internal divisions. You know, the things that were tearing Christians apart one from another. And in Africa, you know, the division was over the legitimacy of the hierarchy, because during the time of persecution, there were certain Christian bishops who had succumbed to pressure and handed over books to be burned, Christian books. So because of this sacrilege, some of their faithful would no longer respect them as legitimate occupants of the office of bishop. So there was kind of a rebellion there, and some people were choosing one bishop over another, and there were alternative bishops in a lot of the churches there. And then there's the question of who owns the property. So it becomes a legal mess, and it becomes a real threat to the civic order when you have a majority Christian population, and yet the Christians are fighting with one another. So Constantine faced that problem in North Africa. He also faced the doctrinal problem of Arianism, which began in Egypt but spread everywhere from Egypt. A heretical priest in Alexandria in Egypt was teaching that Jesus was not true God from true God. Jesus was not the Son of God, the eternal Word made flesh, that the Word was not co-eternal with the Father and was not co-equal with the Father. And his heresy was spreading rapidly throughout the empire, and it was seducing some influential people and even many bishops. So you had government officials and bishops going over to Arianism. The way Saint Jerome describes it, he says that it's as if one morning the world awoke to find itself Arian. It happened that suddenly. So that also was a threat to the Christian order and also the social order, because you had so many Christians and they were fighting with one another. So Constantine looked at all of these as genuine problems for the empire, because disunity would make the Romans weaker.
So when it came to Arianism, you know, one of the things Constantine did was he formed the Council of Nicaea, and that seemed to suppress it a bit, but why did Arianism seem to have such a strong foothold? Because it didn't end there. It continued to rear its ugly head throughout the years.
Well, you know, it was a kind of Christianity that that had all the trappings of orthodoxy, all the trappings of the Catholic faith. You know, it had the liturgy that people were accustomed to. It used all the right words, and it had the sacraments, but it really offered people a Christianity that was simplified to the point of blasphemy. You know, it was a Christianity that was palatable for pagans. It said that God is one, as the Christians were saying, but, you know, lots of pagans believed that there was one God. Lots of pagans had reasoned their way to monotheism. You wouldn't find pagans, though, who believed in the Trinity, in the co-eternity of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. You wouldn't find pagans who believed in the full divinity of the Son of God. And once you compromise those doctrines, you are compromising the doctrine of salvation. You are no longer teaching Christianity in fidelity to the apostolic tradition that Jesus gave to the apostles and the apostles handed on to the next generation through the Catholic Church. You know, Arianism was proposing a kind of Christianity light, a Christianity that was palatable to pagans. You know, the only problem with it is that it wasn't true.
Very good point. You know, we talk about, you know, we're focusing this conversation right now on the Roman Empire itself, but in Rome, one of the hard things in the early church was travel, and yet Christians still found a way to do what we would call pilgrimages today to the Holy Land. But how difficult was that for them in that time period to be able to do that travel, to go to other countries, to spread the word?
Well, you know, Christianity enjoyed a certain benefit. I think this too was providential, that in the first century, mariners discovered the trade winds. They learned how to sail on the open sea for the first time. So you could move far more rapidly from one place to another by ship. Also, you know, in the first century, you have Caesar Augustus beginning to build the first worldwide system of roads so that you could move far more quickly on land than ever before. So these things happened coincidentally with the rise of Christianity, that suddenly there was an improvement in travel, and you could get a little more easily from one place to another. A couple of Christian institutions made it even easier on the traveler. Christians established hostels for travelers to make sure that they were safe, because otherwise you were sleeping outside at night, and if you were in a city, you'd be vulnerable to robbers, to violence. So Christians established hostels for pilgrims who were making their way to one or another holy site, and they established hospitals in case you got sick along the way. So all of these things made it a little bit easier. But nonetheless, any pilgrim who undertook such a journey was taking on some risks. You were taking on risks against your person because there were pirates on the sea. There were robbers on the roads, and they were waiting to ambush people who might be traveling with money, as pilgrims often were, because they needed money to buy their food, to get from one place to another. So they did undertake some hardship, but that was part of the package. You know, they were making a sacrifice, a personal sacrifice, in order to grow closer to God.
So as the book winds down, as we wind down our time here together today, what do you feel were some of the contributing factors to the final demise of the Roman Empire?
Oh, my. Well, that's a big question. One is that the barbarians just kept nipping away at the edges of the empire. The other thing is that the empire grew so large that it became unwieldy. It became almost impossible to manage in an efficient way. And so the Romans were always trying to devise a way to divvy up the empire under different administrators and make it work that way. The problem is that these administrators in the East and the West would often turn on one another and make war with one another and try to take each other's territory. So they were just never able to impose an administration that would last very long and that would remain strong against the enemies, the various barbarian tribes like the Goths and the Goths to the north and even in Africa, and then the Persians to the east. Hmm.
So this time period you write a lot about. Is there any particular characters, we'll call them, within this time period that you really like?
I love so many of them, and that's why it was a joy to write this book. I wrote about some of my favorite saints, like Jerome, who translated the Bible into the common language of Latin. I wrote about Cyril of Alexandria, who was a real operator and was able to successfully oppose the bishop in the capital city when he was proposing heretical doctrines about Jesus Christ and the Blessed Mother. There are just so many characters like this in that early period. I also love telling the stories about the women who were in the circle of Jerome, who helped him in his scholarly labors and helped him to establish monastic communities in Palestine. I love Saint Agnes. She's one of my favorite figures from antiquity. My daughter, my oldest daughter, is named after her, and my mother actually had the name Agnes as well. So there are just so many characters. I couldn't possibly home in on one, but I love them all. They were strong, and they really did give us a heritage that we love as Catholics today.
So what is your greatest hope for this Reclaiming Catholic History series?
You know, that people will see the joy of knowing history, and they'll want to read more. They'll want to know more about their own history, their own past, their own heritage, their own ancestry. You know, what we've been given through the apostolic tradition, what has faithfully been passed down through the generations, what has been believed always and everywhere and by everyone, as St. Vincent said so long ago. So, all of that, to know the joy of history, but then to also know the confidence of being a Christian who has a sense of history, who knows that the gates of hell have not prevailed against the church, even though it seemed in certain periods as if that victory was certain. They have never prevailed, and they won't prevail ever, because we have God's guarantee on that. This gives us confidence going forward when we have a clear sense of our past. Mm.
So what's coming up next in the series?
Well, the next one out will be the first volume in the series, which is a look at the early church, those first three centuries before the church became legal. And that's by my good friend and sometime co-author, Jim Papandrea.
Awesome. Mike, thanks so much for spending time with us today. Where can people find this series and the book, The Church in the Roman Empire?
Well, they can find them at their favorite Catholic bookstore, and that's where I always recommend going. They're also available in all the usual online places as well. You can find them from Ave Maria Press online.
And again, thanks so much, Mike. It's always a joy to spend time with you. Any closing thoughts?
Well, thanks again for having me, Pete. It's always good to talk about this period and about our heritage as Christians. As I said before, I love the saints of this era. They give us a witness, and they give us a gift that we can still recognize in the parishes that we love living in today.
All right, and with that, you've been listening to Off the Shelf here on Redbox Media. I'm your host, Pete Sox, a Catholic book blogger, and until next time, God bless.
It's so much more than just a profile picture. At Catholic Singles, our platform offers you many opportunities to get to know the person behind the picture, Sign up today at CatholicSingles.com. Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at KaneFord.com.